Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
No matter where you come from, what you've done, what you own, or who you are, the sum total of all your experiences is contained within a fragile 3-pound mass of neural tissue. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The human brain, as my guest will explain, is literally the most complex object ever discovered in the universe. And while mysteries as to its operation abound, we have come a long way toward understanding how the brain allows us to perceive the world, provide consciousness, and be exquisitely adapted to serve us in almost any environment in which the rest of our body finds itself. Neuroscientist David Eagleman is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine. The new 6-part PBS series he's hosting is called The Brain, and the first episode debuts October 14th. David, welcome back to Think.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Wonderful to be here again.
I love that you call the brain the most complex object we've discovered in the universe. I guess I knew that was true, but I hadn't thought about it that way.
Yeah, there's really nothing that we can even wrap our heads around about it. I mean, it's made of 100 billion neurons. Every neuron, these are the specialized cell type in the brain. Every single neuron is about as complicated as the city of Dallas. It has the entire human genome in it. It's trafficking millions of proteins around. And each of these neurons is connected to about 10,000 of its neighbors. So that's 1,000 trillion connections, all of which are active every second of your life. And so it's something that's very, you know, it bankrupts our language. We have no way of even talking about things of that complexity.
And it actually is pretty helpful to think of the brain in terms of a city, because if you walked into a major city and said, okay, where's the economy located? You couldn't absolutely just point to, you know, a 6-block section. The economy is all about the interaction.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same in the brain, where it's all about the interaction of all of these pieces and parts. There's always sort of been this hope that people have had that they can just point to a part of the brain and say, ah, that's where your sense of humor is or your generosity or so on. This was the old science of phrenology, where they looked at bumps on the brain and tried to assign functions to them. But in fact, yeah, it's all about the interaction.
Your first fascination with the brain and perception and consciousness started with an accident you had as a kid.
Yeah, when I was 8 years old, I fell off of the roof of a house and I fell all the way to the ground and broke my nose. And it seemed to take a very long time this fall. And during the fall, I was thinking about my options and what I could grab and how, what, you know, and I was also thinking about Alice in Wonderland and how this must have been what it was like when she fell down the rabbit hole. And so later, when I was in high school physics, I calculated how long the fall took, and it turns out it was only 0.8 of a second. And I couldn't figure out why it was so fast, but it seemed to take so long. So that got me on a real fascination about the way the brain constructs reality and how whatever our brain tells us is going on, that's how we experience things. And my father's a psychiatrist, a forensic psychiatrist, and through him, I, you know, got to see many patients who have, for example, schizophrenia. And when they're in the middle of a delusion, they totally believe that as their reality. That is every bit as real to them as what you and I might be experiencing right now. And of course, we know what this is like, because every night when we close our eyes and dream, we're trapped in this other strange reality and we believe it completely. So these things collectively just got me really interested in what is happening in this closed theater of the skull, and how what our brain tells us is what we experience and take to be true.
I was thinking about you and your research into temporal perception this weekend when I was at the state fair, and people were on that god-awful device where you're on some kind of a bungee cord and you swing, you know, about 200 yards above the crowd. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, I know a couple that actually got married that way. As soon as they said, I do, they were released and they swung out. Yeah, the general story is that things that are very scary seem to last longer. And so I did an experiment on this some years ago where I actually, it was up in Dallas that I had to do it, because it's illegal to do in Houston, as it turns out. And it's called SCAD diving, where that stands for suspended catch air device. And we dropped people from a 150-foot-tall tower at an amusement park called Go Jump. And and we measured their time perception as they were falling backwards, and they landed in a net going 60 miles an hour below. And what we found from that is that time doesn't actually go in slow motion during these events. Instead, your memory is laid down with more density, such that in retrospect, you feel like you have so much footage to draw upon, and it seems like it took a long time.
All right. Our brains are not ready for prime time at birth. There's a lot that we still have to learn, in part just about how to perceive the world. What are the advantages of having a brain that isn't able to understand depth perception and where sound is coming from and what things are that we experience with our senses right away?
It may not be that there's a direct advantage to not being able to understand that stuff, but the major advantage humans have compared to most of our cousins in the animal kingdom is that we drop into the world with brains that are remarkably unfinished. And so, you know, if you look at a baby zebra being born, after just a couple minutes, he wobbles to its little, you know, its little pencil legs and it starts running. And if you look at a dolphin being born, it starts swimming right away and so on. Those animals are coming to the table more pre-programmed, and that seems to have certain advantages for them right away. The disadvantage is that every zebra is kind of like every other zebra, and same with the dolphins and all the other animals. And so what that means is if you took them out of their ecosystem and put them somewhere that's very foreign for them, like on top of the Himalayas or something, they wouldn't thrive there. But humans, because we're so unfinished when we come into the world, we have extremely flexible brains. This is known as brain plasticity. We absorb the world around us. We absorb our local culture and language and habits and costumes and all kinds and, you know, all the scientific knowledge that our forebears have brought with them. And so what that means is humans, you know, we've taken over the whole planet. We can live in any ecosystem because we're so flexible. We adapt so well. So we, you know, we arrive a little more sloppy, and as a result, we're able to mold ourselves to the world around us.
You feature a guy in the first episode who was blinded in a childhood accident, and then, like 40 years later, he has surgery that technically restores his sight. But learning what all this visual data means is another story entirely, it turns out.
Yeah, so the assumption that a lot of people have is that vision is about the eyes. But in fact, it has almost nothing to do with the eyes. It's all about what's happening inside the brain. So this particular man, his name is Mike May, was blinded in a chemical explosion that scarred up his corneas. So there was no light getting through. So for 40 years, he was blind. Then he heard about this pioneering stem cell treatment that he could get, and he decided to go for it. And he underwent the surgery. And when they took the bandages off, it was a textbook success in the sense that his eyes, his corneas were now passing light. So there were, you know, photons of light striking his retina and moving back into his brain. And that seemed wonderful. But it turns out that he couldn't see in the way that we think about seeing because his brain couldn't figure out how to interpret these signals. It had been too long since it had these signals coming in. And it's not about just having clear eyes. It's about knowing how to interpret the data. And the way to understand this is that the brain is locked in silence and darkness inside of the skull, and all it ever sees are electrochemical signals coursing around in there. It doesn't have direct access to the outside world at all. And so what happened in Mike May's case is that all these electrochemical signals started moving around in there, but there was no way to understand what they meant.
I knew somebody once who was born with amblyopia, which is like a lazy eye. And the brain ultimately turned off the eye that didn't work all that well, even though the eye itself was healthy. And so if you asked him to cover his good eye, he could see things clearly with the bad eye, but he couldn't read. He couldn't do a lot of things that he should have been able to do.
Yeah, exactly. And that has everything to do with what's happening on the opposite side of the head from the eyes, where your visual cortex is. So at the back of your head, your visual cortex is distributing its real estate between information coming from left eye and right eye. And if one of the eyes is sort of off looking at things that are less salient while the other eye is pinned on what's going on, it starts giving more and more real estate to the good eye and less to the bad eye. And so what actually happened with your friend is there was nothing wrong with the eye itself except that it was misaligned. But visually, the problem was that the visual cortex had sort of given up on it and had just given less and less real estate to it. So, by the way, what you do, what physicians do now in the case of amblyopia is you, while the person is a child, let's say under 8 years old, you put a patch over the good eye so that the bad eye has a chance to get some real estate back. But you have to do it while the kid is young.
My guest is neuroscientist David Eagleman. He's director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine, and he's host of a new 6-part PBS series called The Brain. The first episode debuts October 14th. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think. Back in 2 minutes with David Eagleman.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with neuroscientist David Eagleman, who is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine. His new 6-part PBS series, The Brain, debuts October 14th. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. This is really interesting, David. Part of what happens as we grow and develop is that we actually reduce the number of connections in our brains to make the important ones stronger and let the ones that don't seem to matter as much shrivel away.
That's right. We sort of come to the table being ready for anything. I mean, this is part of what's special about the human brain. And the way it works is the language you're exposed to and the culture you're exposed to and so on shapes your brain. But the way it shapes it is not by adding new things to it. It's by carving things away. So you become who you are, not by growing new things in the brain, but by removing things, by pruning it. It's the way that Michelangelo described finding the statue of David in the block of marble.
And so personality-wise, you didn't go into cloning in this series, but if you or I were to have a clone, an infant born today that had exactly the same genes that we had but was raised in a different way, it would be a different person.
Totally different person. Yeah. Who we are comes about as a confluence of our genes and our environment. So the genes that you arrive with, these give you certain predispositions. And then every experience you have from the family of origin that you drop into and the neighborhood and the culture and the generation, those all combine with your genetics to send your brain off on a unique developmental trajectory. And as a result, brains are all very different. If you look around any room, you'll notice that there's a lot of variability in people's faces, for example, where there's that much variability in people's brains, too. Brains are like fingerprints.
I love this. In a later episode, you put adults and teenagers in like a shop window on a busy street to be gawked at by passing strangers. Adults didn't love it, but they were, you know, stressed at a pretty constant low-level rate. You put teenagers in that situation and they are dying.
Yeah. It turns out that the way the brain unpacks, it has particular software programs. And this is no surprise. I mean, just look at what happens when a person turns 13-ish and goes through puberty. Suddenly, things that weren't very interesting to you before become really interesting. And that's because your brain is moving along a particular developmental timeline and acting exactly as it should be. One of the things that's interesting about the teen brain is the way that all these networks are interacting with one another when it comes to things like understanding one's self in a social context. And it turns out that for teens, just because of the way their brain is unpacking, they are really, really sensitive to being stared at, being gawked at. Their sense of self is really hooked up to other areas that are involved in high stress. And of course, other areas of the brain that are involved in, for example, risk-taking are coupling up differently with parts of their brain involved in their peer group. So they'll take all kinds of risks in the presence of their peers. And it's not that they're being rebellious or silly about something. It's that their brain is unpacking right on schedule.
What's our understanding about the age at which the medial prefrontal cortex is fully developed suggest about the age that we call young people adults in our society?
Yeah, so the whole prefrontal cortex in general is the slowest part of the brain to develop. You know, parts of your brain that are involved in walking and running and speaking language and so on, these get pretty well wired up early, but the front part of the brain, the part just behind the forehead, this is involved in navigating yourself through society and in things like impulse control. And this is the most slowly developing part of the brain, and it doesn't reach full development until the early 20s. And I think there's a sense in which societies have always had an intuition about this, and that's why children in all modern legal systems get treated differently. They're treated under juvenile law because it's understood that this part of their brain isn't as well adapted to good decision-making as an adult brain. And hand-in-hand with that goes the idea that there's more brain plasticity available. So that means that they have more chance to respond to incentives and deterrence and to change.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Bruce in Arlington. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on. And I just want to say I really appreciate KERA as my local station.
Thank you.
I just, knowing what we know about the disease CTE and its prevalence in certain sports, specifically football, do you see in an anytime near future maybe at least being banned at the Pee Wee level or at least elementary school level?
CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Exactly. So thank you so much for that question. Yeah, this is, for any listeners that don't know, this is what happens when you get hit in the head repeatedly. And this is something that characterizes most NFL players, also boxers. When you look at their brains after a career, is that they've got real damage to their brain that comes about not just from one or two concussions, but lots of them. And it's extremely damaging to the brain. I don't know how it's going to fall out in terms of whether people legislate against football. A lot of people think that's probably a pretty good idea. In parallel, people are working on other solutions like designing better helmets. It's not easy. Nobody's sort of nailed that one yet, but people are trying that. And of course, there's a lot of emphasis now on changing the way that people tackle. So one of the things that I've done in my lab is I developed mobile software. This is called Brain Check. And we can use this to measure for concussions right at the sidelines. So in 5 minutes of essentially playing what's essentially like a video game on an iPad, I can harvest 11 measures of brain function, things like reaction time and coordination and perception and cognition and memory. And I can put together a signature of brain health and figure out if an athlete's been concussed. And at least we can get people out of the game very quickly that way. Whereas traditionally what happens is a kid goes to the sideline, the coach says, "Are you okay?" And the kid says, "I think I'm okay." And the coach says, "How many fingers am I holding up?" And then, you know, the kid ends up getting sent back into the game. And so this is a way that at least we can have a quantified, time-stamped version of when somebody should be taken out.
Do you think every athlete should have a baseline score for cognitive function?
That's exactly what we do. So the first thing we do, we're in many high schools around Houston already, and that's exactly what we do. We take baselines on all the athletes, and we encourage them to retake the baselines every couple of months. And then if there's any incident during a game or a practice, we immediately have a comparison against that baseline.
A couple of weeks ago on this show, I had an interview with the choreographer Twyla Tharp, and she grew up in a very musical household, and she studied dance, and she talked about when she was learning to play the piano, she would hear a note and see a color, and hear another note and see a different color, and I knew that this was something you could tell us more about.
Yeah, this is called synesthesia, and it represents a crosstalk between the senses. So there are many different forms of synesthesia. Some people see sounds like Twyla. Some people When they look at letters of the alphabet, that will trigger a color experience. Other people, when they hear something, it'll put a taste in their mouth. For other people, when they put food in their mouth, it puts a feeling on their fingertips. Essentially, any cross-blending of the senses you can imagine, we have found cases like that. Now, it used to be thought that synesthesia was very rare, something like 1 in 10,000, but we now know that it's actually really common. It's about 3% of the population has some form or another of synesthesia. So in my laboratory, we've been studying that for years, all the way from neuroimaging down to the level of the genetics. And we've now rigorously measured and quantified about 25,000 synesthetes in my lab.
Day to day, what's different about people with synesthesia? Are they more creative or do they tend to be?
You know, there's been a rumor about that for a long time. I'm not sure I'd buy it, and I'll tell you why. Because if every time I play the note C, you experience lavender blue, that's not actually creativity. That's being stuck in a rut. I mean, there's nothing there's nothing that makes her more creative just by dint of that. So, you know, a lot of people like to list a number of famous musicians and artists and so on who are synesthetic. But in fact, we don't really know how many accountants are synesthetic or deep sea divers or anything like that to compare it to.
Let's go back.
So at the moment, I don't think they're more creative.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Sam on the line in Dallas. Hey, Sam.
Hi. I use reading glasses, and without them, the text is totally blurred. But occasionally, with my reading glasses, I'll lose a lens. I put on the glasses with one lens, and believe it or not, or I'm sure you would, it's totally clear. It's the same as if I've got both lens. How is that? It makes no sense, but evidently it does.
Yeah. The reason that works is because your brain is taking the information from the good eye, from the eye with the lens in front of it, and it's just going ahead and using that. I actually implement this trick. I wear one contact lens for distance vision. And so what my brain is doing is actually doing close-up reading with one eye and distance vision with the other eye. But I can't tell the difference. When I'm looking in the distance, it appears as though my whole view is in focus. And when I'm looking up close, it appears as though everything's in focus. And that's because as long as the brain has the information from one eye or the other, it'll do the right thing with it.
How long did it take you to get used to that system?
No time.
Really?
Right away.
We're speaking this hour with neuroscientist David Eagleman. He's director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine and host of a new 6-part PBS series called The Brain. It debuts October 14th. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with neuroscientist David Eagleman, who directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine. He's host of a brand new 6-part series on PBS called The Brain. The first episode debuts October 14th. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, everyone is excited about the possibility for artificial intelligence and autonomous robots. There has been, like, no more sobering lesson about how complex our brains are, though, than trying to duplicate them in something outside of us.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially some of the smartest people on the planet have been working on artificial intelligence since the 60s, and we still don't have anything that's much better than the Roomba vacuum cleaner. We certainly don't have the C-3POs that we all imagined when we were kids we would have by some futuristic date like 2015. So the question is, what went wrong? The answer is, it's just a really hard problem. And I think that as humans, we tend to fall into traps a lot of trying to think about the brain like a digital computer and trying to, you know, make attempts that way. But as it turns out, Mother Nature has had billions of years to run trillions of experiments in parallel, and she's come up with some tricks that we haven't even scratched the surface of yet. So there's still a lot to be done there to really achieve artificial intelligence.
What's on the horizon for enhancing what nature gave us? You say that we're heading for a fundamental change in the relationship between the body, the brain, and the outside world.
Yeah, well, I think we're getting a lot better at reading signals from the brain and being able to use those to control external devices. And we're getting a lot better at feeding new information into the brain. So let me give an example of those. For example, for some people who are paralyzed, and this is one of the things I deal with in the show, the brain, is you can implant electrodes in their brain and you can eavesdrop on the signals that are where their brain is trying to tell their arm to move. You can eavesdrop on those signals and pass those through a computer and have those signals move a robotic arm. And at this point, there are absolutely extraordinary robotic arms that can move and flex and twist and have multiple degrees of freedom. And they look just pretty much like a human arm, but made out of metal. And so we're getting better at figuring out how to take these brain signals and use them to control better bodies. And I think this is going to be the long-term direction that we're moving in as a species, is getting off of these meat puppets that we have and getting onto a stronger substrate, like real bionics. And that's the only hope we have, I think, of interstellar travel, because the current bodies we have just aren't up for the job. The other half of that equation is getting new kinds of information into the brain. So this is something that my lab is deeply into, which is the way I view it is that the brain is essentially a general purpose computational device. And as I mentioned earlier, it's sealed in silence and darkness in the vault of the skull, and it doesn't see the outside world. It just gets signals coming in. Now, those signals come in through these sensors like eyes and ears and nose and fingertip, and we're used to those. But my assertion is that there's nothing fundamental or special about those sensors. That's just what we've inherited from a complex road of evolution. So what we've done in my lab is build a vest. It's worn under the clothing, and it has 40 vibratory motors on it, like the little motors in your cell phone that buzz. And we can feed in new information into the brain through dynamic patterns of activity on the skin of your torso. And what we're finding is that the brain can unlock these new kinds of senses and have a new kind of experience. So as one example, we're working on this with deafness. So for people who are totally deaf, we capture the auditory world and convert it into these moving patterns of vibration. And people can come to understand the auditory world through their torso. And this is, you know, this is going to revolutionize what is possible for deafness. But beyond that, we can feed in new kinds of data streams. So we're feeding in all kinds of things now, including stock market data and weather data and for drone pilots, feeding in the pitch, yaw, roll, and orientation of the plane so that they can actually feel the plane, what it's doing. All kinds of things we're experimenting with at the moment. But I think what this expands is the kinds of sensory experiences we'll be able to have. And I gave a talk on this at TED in March. So if anyone's interested, you can go to TED.com and see the full talk on the vest.
Some people think that any kind of enhancement to our sensory perception should really just be correcting a deficiency, right? So if you have a disease or you've had an accident of some kind, we should only use these technologies to restore what most of us consider normal, natural function. I would venture to guess that you disagree and you think there might be applications for this, making people who are already healthy and fully functional better.
Yeah, I do think that. It turns out that the slice of reality that we have access to is unbelievably small. So if you take something like light, which is electromagnetic radiation, we actually see less than 1/10 trillionth of that spectrum. And that little sliver that we see, we call that visible light. But all the other stuff, like radio waves and gamma waves and x-rays and microwaves and radio frequencies. All that stuff is made of exactly the same stuff. It's all light. It's just that we can't see most of it. And that's because we don't have specialized biological receptors for other parts of the spectrum. But, of course, as our society has moved forward with its scientific knowledge, we now use x-rays in hospitals so that we can see things that are clinically useful, and we build little machines in the dashboards of our cars so that we can listen to radio programs like this one, and we pass information back and forth along all these other channels. We're already taking advantage of the fact that we have a very limited natural ability to see the spectrum, and so now we're expanding our view to other parts. And you know, I think it's the same thing that's going to happen. We're just moving it closer. We're moving it onto our bodies instead of in the dashboard of our cars or in a hospital room. We're actually going to make this part of ourselves.
Will we need human bodies if we can transplant something like human consciousness into a machine?
So this is a great question. There's something called the computational hypothesis of brain function, which just says, look, the biological wetware of the brain isn't the important part. What's important are the algorithms, the computer programs that's being run on top of all this wetware. So in other words, it's what the brain is implementing that's the important part. Now, if that's true, then it suggests we could replicate your brain out of another substrate, like beer cans and tennis balls. And if we got the operations right and it's running the same algorithm, then that would be you. And if I said to this giant beer can and tennis ball machine, you know, hey, Chris, how are you feeling in there? And you'd say, oh, I'm feeling fine. It's a little cold, whatever. But the idea is that if it's running those same computations, then it is you. Now, we don't know if the computational hypothesis is correct. I would say it's, you know, operationally, it's probably how most of us go into the lab and operate. The reason being that we see every day that when anything changes in the brain, then who you are changes. So you are irrevocably tied to this 3 pounds of tissue and its exact operations. In other words, when there's even little damage to the brain, stroke, tumor, traumatic brain injury, that can change who you are, your decision-making, your risk aversion, and so on. That's how we know that you are tied to the operation of this stuff. So the question is, can we replicate this stuff onto a stronger substrate and or in a computer so that you can actually live in silica and be like Neo in the Matrix, where you are, you know, enjoying this other kind of world, but it's all a simulation? That has, by the way, led to a serious question among neuroscientists and philosophers, which is, how would we know if we are already living in a simulation?
Full of wetware that someone else has built for us.
Yeah.
All right, I want to leave off with this. To map a single human brain's connectivity entirely would take a zettabyte of data. How much data is that?
That is the total computational capacity of our planet right now. So it turns out that to simulate a human brain, you know, we can sort of point to the place on the horizon where we're heading with that, but it's a long way off because it's just an enormously complicated and big data problem. So obviously we're moving in the right direction because the computational speed and power of the planet is increasing exponentially. So we'll eventually get to the place where we have a zettabyte as a modest computational force of the type you might wear on your body. But right now, it's the whole planet's worth of computers.
Don't look at the Best Buy near you by Christmas for this sort of thing.
Next Christmas.
Neuroscientist David Eagleman is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine. The new 6-part PBS series he is hosting is called The Brain, and the first episode debuts October 14th. David, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us today.
Thank you, Chris.